From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. On today's episode, filmmaker and playwright John Patrick Shanley on writing memorable characters. Shanley won the Oscar with his screenplay for Moonstruck, as well as a Pulitzer and a Tony for his play Doubt, which he later adapted for the screen.
What I realized with Doubt, it was the hardest screenplay I ever wrote because it resisted being a screenplay. It was a four-character play, and three of the characters are dressed in black from head to foot. Nobody drives anywhere. Nobody kisses anybody. Nobody shoots anything. What are we going to do for, you know, an hour and 40 minutes? It's how do I make this cinematic?
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Filmmaker and playwright John Patrick Shanley's credits include the stage plays Prodigal Son, Outside Mullingar, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, Savage in Limbo, Dirty Story, Defiance, and Beggars in the House of Plenty. His theatrical work is performed extensively across the United States and around the world. His play, Doubt, received both the Tony Award and the Pulitzer Prize. He later adapted and directed Doubt for the screen. The film, starring Meryl Streep, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, and Viola Davis, was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Adapted Screenplay. Shanley's other films include 5 Corners, Alive, Joe vs. the Volcano, and, of course, Moonstruck, for which he received both the Writers Guild of America Award and the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. Barbara Morgan spoke with John Patrick Shanley at a special event held at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas in 2016.
I was really born a writer. I started writing when I was about 10 years old, and I wrote poetry, you know, that kind of Edgar Allan Poe poetry where you have a dream that you've killed somebody and you wake up and there's a bloody knife on your pillow. But it was a natural impulse, and by the time I was 12, I came in 5th place in the state in something called the Mooney Essay Contest, which was a Catholic thing. And the subject was how Catholic teenagers can win the world for Christ. I don't know what the, you know, person who came in first wrote, but mine was pretty fevered. So I had a natural proclivity for writing, and as life went on, I didn't have any role models. Where I grew up, nobody made a living in the arts. Nobody was in the arts. But this was something that was inherent and natural to me. And when I was about 14, I used to go to the store and I would buy paperbacks, because I like to read and I read a lot. And one day I bought a book called The Dialogues of Plato. And I immediately had a feeling of recognition. I'm like, this is what I've been looking for. The clarity of the questions and answers and the spaciousness with which Socrates would pursue an idea with whoever he was drawing out. And for a long time, I thought it was simply Socrates. And much later, I thought, no, you dope, it was dialogue. I recognized dialogue as a form that ultimately I would come to, though I did not begin to actually write dialogue until after I got out of the Marine Corps when I was 22. And I was at NYU. I went back to NYU after leaving for a few years. And I took all the writing courses, and the only one left that I hadn't taken was Introduction to Playwriting. So I took that, and as soon as I started writing in that form, I recognized that that's what I wanted to do, and I've done it ever since.
So the Marine Corps drove you to write great dialogue? That's what I got out of that.
Well, you know, actually, the Marine Corps, I didn't really have that much to write about. And I, on some level, recognized that I needed to have a life if I was going to write about things. And the Marine Corps was part of that happening.
I mean, is that where you basically discover that dialogue is a thing that you're not just interested in, but particularly good at?
Just felt very natural to me. And I liked the idea of telling a story that way. In a way, you're less in charge of the story when it's a play. It's a strange thing, you know, because when you're in a book, you know, you sort of lead people through your narration into the story. You say, this is going to be a story about such and such. And you, one way or another, you either drop them into the middle of the story or you begin at the beginning of the story or the end of the story, and you guide them very consciously in a way. And in a play, the audience recognizes what's story and what's not. So, you know, we're up here and we're talking. Either there's a story going on or there isn't. If there's no story going on, we can talk. We can talk for 2 hours. But there's nothing that's hooking the audience and making them go, you know, there's something that I'm waiting to find out. And I have to sit and experience this thing in order to get to that kernel of information that I hunger to know. And I like that, but there's something also, an X factor, that plays are mysterious to me. I think all true living works of art are mysterious on some fundamental level, just like people are mysterious. You know, people talk. I sit and I'm like having a conversation with somebody, and on one level, I'm listening to what they say and I'm responding to that, offering what I have. On another level, the whole time I have a secret question is like, who the hell are you? And what is this really? What's really going on here? Or if nothing's going on, why is nothing going on? What is that? You know? And I've certainly had that experience many times.
One of the things that seems so prevalent in your work are the primal aspects of people and the exploration of, you know, their sexuality and how it affects their decisions in life, their good and bad decisions. I mean, where is that coming from?
We're metaphorical beings. Money isn't money. And money's nothing in and of itself. It's whatever we put on it. Sex, like if you have a dream, you have a sexual dream, it's not simply about, you know, the tactile experience of sex. It's about connection in some sense, or fertility, or the attempt to reach another human being. I think that applies to everything. Whatever we're doing something else. We're never just doing what we're doing. I mean, when I write a play, I am attempting to connect. You know, I've been in the audience a million times at my own stuff and other people's stuff, and I've felt when I connect with the audience and when I don't. And I feel them even when they're not there. And so when I write, they're there with me. And what I always say about the audience is, the audience could be all idiots. Together, they're a genius. And if you ignore that, you ignore it at your peril. And the second that you do something that you already know the answer to, they smell it and they go to sleep. They don't care anymore. As long as you're right there with them, trying to figure it out, they'll stay with you. But you got to fight. You got to fight really hard to stay in the present and try to get into the future. So one of the things I'm, you know, certainly trying to do when I'm doing a play, another thing is that I am trying to understand something that I don't understand yet. I have some question in my life, some obstacle, some barrier, some aspiration that's just beyond where I am. And I'm frustrated and I don't know how to get there. And I'm using this play to attempt to get there or express my heartbreak that I can't get there. And through, you know, doing one or both of those things, the audience will go like, yeah, you know, I know what you mean. That's where I am too. It's sort of an invitation to live together as opposed to all of us living in separate compartments.
So in that process of creating for theater, you have an overt relationship with the audience constantly. So you've had a couple of well-accepted works in theater, and then you decide you want to move to film. or jump to film or coexist with film. I'm not sure what was in your head. You can tell us that. But why? I mean, that's such a different medium. The collaboration is not so much with the audience.
Well, I mean, first of all, it is with the audience, but, you know, you have the benefit of having spent years in the theater connecting with a live audience so that you can carry some of that sensibility over. I imagine, like everybody in this room, I have spent my whole life scheming. How am I going to survive? You know? So I was a playwright. I was a poet. And I was a poet in the Bronx, which is sort of like just having a sign on you that says, hit me. And I had to find a way to be a poet in the Bronx, and I did find a way. I had no interest in being separated from my fellow man and woman by poetry. I had an interest in poetry binding me to my community, and I still do. So here I am in the Bronx in a very anti-intellectual environment and very violent and pretty honest in its way about certain things. And so I, to some degree, found a way to be accepted as a poet on my own terms in that society, which involves some fistfights and stuff. But I never, you know, seriously, in any practical sense, thought about materially surviving as a poet. I wasn't really worried about that. You know, I worked as a sandwich maker in a deli shop chain, and the good thing about it was that their bags that they put the sandwiches in were white, and so I could write on them. And I still, in my filing cabinets, have all these paper bags with these poems on them that I would write in my spare time in between making sandwiches. So I wasn't doing that to make money. I was doing it because I had to. I wanted to. It enhanced my pleasure of living. You know, then I went back to school after, I think, a five-year hiatus. And I went, and I was after the Marine Corps. And so I had a lot more discipline and focus. And I didn't still think about applying, how am I going to make a living? I just didn't worry about that. I knew I could make a living. I knew I could make sandwiches, or I could unload trucks, or I could paint people's apartments. What I was more concerned with was having an interesting life and a rich experience of life. I was very worried about it, really, that I might not, that I might be a jerk, that I might waste my life, that I might be on my deathbed and going, I blew it. I didn't do it. And, you know, Leonardo da Vinci on his deathbed burst into tears and said, the Medicis created me and destroyed me. And I thought, I do not want to be Leonardo da Vinci. That hack. So during that time that I was, you know, writing these poems and I was doing this very hands-on stuff with the material world, I was pretty happy. Then I went back to NYU and I'm like, I am actually now, my job is to learn. And I was thrilled. I read everything. I got up every morning at 5 o'clock and wrote for 3 hours and made the university do a really good job of educating me.
Austin Film Festival's On Story will be back in a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with filmmaker and playwright John Patrick Shanley speaking with Barbara Morgan at a special event in 2016. Shanley's credits include the films Moonstruck, Joe vs. the Volcano, and Doubt, starring Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Clips in the following segment, copyright Paragon Entertainment Corporation and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Pictures Incorporated.
I got into screenwriting because I got a National Endowment for the Arts grant. That would be enough for me to live for 1 year. And I knew that if I didn't do anything to change my situation after that year, I'd be back painting people's apartments and unloading trucks again, which is what I was doing for a living then. And so I said, well, I'm going to have to write a movie. And then I set about, like, how do you write a movie? And I read maybe dozen screenplays. And I read one called Scarface that hadn't been made yet by Oliver Stone. And I went, oh, I get it. I get what this is. Because when I read it, he described the main character, Tony Montana, as this in incredibly lush romantic terms that I thought was just really bad, really purple prose. And then I thought, yeah, reading it, that's what you think. But if you were watching it, and it was Al Pacino who was in the boat that's going through the sea from Cuba and his hair is blowing in the wind, you'd buy it. It's a different thing. Nobody's saying this in the movie, but you're describing for the cameraman and the director what the experience is for us. And I was like, oh, okay. And so then I began to think about, what am I going to write about? I thought, well, I'll write about my childhood because I know it so well. And I started to think about visual images from my childhood that I wanted to put in the movie. Forget what the story is. I don't care what the story is. It's a visual medium. And I just thought about, you know, this girl I knew who always walked, a St. Bernard every morning. And I thought, putting the St. Bernard in the movie. I like St. Bernards. How a woman fell or jumped out of a window across the street from my home to her death, and a collie leapt out after her and fell to, right, there you go. The woman, nothing. The collie, oh. And images like that. And then after I had, you know, a few pages of images like this, then I thought, okay, now what story can I tell that these images, that I can use them all? And I wrote this movie, Five Corners, which got made and was the start of my career.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International is also available to stream or download. Subscribe now to get parts of our show you may have missed. The podcast version of our show features exclusive Austin Film Festival content, from year-round events with today's hottest filmmakers to historic moments from the Austin Film Festival archive going back almost 25 years. On Story can be found on your favorite podcast app, iTunes, Stitcher, or at onstory.tv. Back to award-winning screenwriter John Patrick Shanley, speaking with Barbara Morgan at a special event at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas, in 2016.
I want to move now to Moonstruck. Mm-hmm. Obviously, your Academy Award winning script, and how that experience played out, especially in the sense of you've come from this world of theater, you've really controlled your own work for the most part, and now you're moving into a world where you hook up with a director and you have to tell the story through someone else, essentially. The script, I think, for Moonstruck was originally called The Bride and the Wolf. What was on the page compared to what ended up on that screen?
There's one line in the movie that I didn't write, that Olympia Dukakis would be only too happy to tell you. But what I did was I wrote my first four films on speculation. That is, I wrote exactly what I wanted. And then after it was written, then and only then did I send it out to directors, potential directors. And if they wanted to make it, I would sit down with them and say, tell me about what you want to do. If I didn't like what they said. I said, nah, I don't want to do that. And I go home. So moonstruck, I rode a movie. You know, I grew up in an Irish and Italian neighborhood. I spent a lot of time in Italian households, Italian-American households. And I was enamored of how different they were from the Irish household because they actually cared about food, for instance.
I have a feeling this is going to be just delicious.
You're Johnny's brother.
Yeah.
Don't look at me like that, okay?
Hi, Pop.
Buongiorno. What's the matter, Pop?
I am old. The old are not wanted. And if they say it, they have no weight. But my son, I must speak. You must pay for the wedding of your only daughter. You break your house through pride. There. I've said it.
It's okay, Pop. If she gets married, I'll pay for the whole thing.
They cared what they were wearing. I never forget my friend Alfonso Antonio Striano. We were going out, and he got in front of his mother's three-part vanity mirror, worked on his hair for, I don't know, 10 minutes, and then went into a cloud of hidden magic to hold it in place. And when by the time that cloud dissipated, I was forever changed. I was just like, you can do that? You can use your mother's hairspray and not, like, explode? That the exoticism of the Italian-American household, for me, mixed with the love of language that I grew up with in my own home, which was the great strength of the Irish, together, you know, created the atmosphere out of which that I wrote Moonstruck, together with my own great longing for love. And the women that I knew at that time who were in the second half of their 30s and who were sort of faced with this fork in the road, do I take this guy who I can get, or do I hold out for Mr. Wright, who I've never met? And are you actually going to choose somebody who may not exist over this guy who's right here? And I thought, what if you meet this guy the day after you say yes to this guy? Which is, of course, what always ends up happening anyway.
What's the matter with you?
My scalp is not getting enough blood sometimes. Have some dessert.
No, I shouldn't.
Will you marry me?
What? Huh?
Will you marry me?
Bobo, take the card away.
Very good, Mr. Loretta.
Are you proposing marriage to me?
Yes.
All right. You know I was married and that my husband died, but what you don't know is I think he and I had bad luck.
What do you mean?
Well, we got married down at the city hall, and I think it gave bad luck the whole marriage.
I don't understand.
Right from the start, we didn't do it right, okay? Could you kneel down?
On the floor?
Yeah, on the floor.
This is a good suit.
I know that. I helped you pick it out. It came with two pairs of pants. You know, Johnny, it's for luck. I mean, a man proposes marriage to a woman, he should kneel down.
And that was sort of the basis for writing Moonstruck. And I, you know, I lived in an apartment with holes in the walls and broken windows in Washington Heights at that time. And I loved this apartment. I remember the superintendent coming in for something, nice guy named Ralph, who I liked very much. And he would say, there's a hole in your wall. Let me fix it for you. And I'm like, Ralph, I love that hole. You can't replicate that. You know, I can't get that. If you take that, we're never going to get that back. That kind of La Boheme feeling of that apartment very much imbued the script. And Lawrence Kasdan, who did The Big Chill and Silverado and a bunch of other stuff, he read it and he called immediately, can I have it? And it's like Norman Jewison had gotten it the week before. And that's how Moonstruck came about.
Well, so the themes in there, I mean, the interesting thing to me was this Irish person writing something that was so deep in the Italian community, clearly. And there's these themes of bad luck and the just the almost musical dialogue of the people in it. I mean, you talk about La Boheme, but how did that come about? That, I mean, is this like an obsession that happened with opera right before you happened to write the script, or had you always been a big fan of
that story? Actually, I wasn't particularly interested in opera, but I kept getting criticized as a playwright. They'd say, this is like opera. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, people would criticize my work saying, this is bigger than life. And I'd be like, maybe your life. And, you know, the experiences that people have inside are big a lot of the time, you know? Sometimes you meet somebody and, you know, they say, you know, this is Mary. It's like, nice to meet you, Mary. And inside, it's gigantic thing is happening. And nobody knows about it. And your privilege as an artist is you get to, like, turn that inside out. And show that, do that, be that, if that's what you want to do. Which will be what I want to do. You know, I like to turn things inside out so you can see a bit more about what's really going on. Because we trivialize our lives a lot of the time, you know. We have these gigantic feelings and say, oh, yes, I enjoyed meeting you. Aw. You know, it was so much more than that. But the timidity of the social mechanism very often prevents us from being who we actually are.
Well, so that reminds me of this particular scene in this movie that does feel a lot bigger than life and more operatic than how the beginning of the movie is set up. And that's the scene where you first meet Nicolas Cage's character and, you know, the unveiling of his hand and the speech he gives to Loretta.
You're going to marry my brother Johnny.
Yeah, would you like to go someplace so we could talk?
I have no life.
Excuse me?
I have no life. My brother Johnny took my life from me.
I don't understand you.
And now he's getting married. He has his. He's getting his. And he wants me to come. What is life?
You know, I didn't come here to upset you.
They say bread is life. And I bake bread, and I sweat and shovel this stinking dough in and out of this hot hole in the wall, and I should be so happy. Huh, sweetie? You want me to come to the wedding of my brother Johnny? Where's my wedding?
Did that feel to you like you were writing a movie, or did that feel to you like you were writing your plays?
I didn't give a You know, I mean, I was writing what the obstacle of the medium, my job was to overcome and use the materials, make them work for me, as opposed to having the materials tell me what I can do. I'm going to tell the materials what they're going to do for me. I grew up with a guy who lost his hand in a bread slicer. And in fact, recently his son contacted me. He didn't know much about his father. And he said, I believe that you wrote about my father and Moonstruck. And I said, yes, I did. He said, anything you could tell me about him would be appreciated. Because he passed away a long time before. And he had a very hard life. Another friend of mine lost his foot in the Bronx and had a wooden foot. I wrote about him as well in another context. Life is hard. It happens to people physically. And it's a dramatization of the fact that life is hard. And we all have these dents, bumps, absences that come about through the very bumpy ride that it is to be alive. And they become part of the emblem of who we are, if we're willing to admit it. You know, a kid is, a person grows up and they're an abused child, and that's part of them. And that's, you know, one of the wounds that they carry, whether you want to look at it as a wooden hand or not. And if a person's going to be overt about what's going on with them, they're like, yeah, I got hurt when I was a kid, and I'm going to carry that for the rest of my life. And this other person didn't get hurt that way, and it makes me angry and feel robbed. But here I am, you know, sweating down here, baking bread, trying to do something to add to the staff of life, the experience of life for other people. I'm doing that, you know? You come here all Pollyanna, like I say, and come to my wedding, you know, while you're in your pink gloves. My life is hard, and I've been through trauma. Do you want to come here with me where I am? Or do you want me to make believe like you're doing, marrying this guy that you don't love?
Some of that film, I don't know how anybody would genre it. I guess it was maybe considered a romantic comedy. Some of that film really reminded me a lot, especially their particular relationship, of Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, mm-hmm. but taken to a funnier, more romantic place, I suppose. Do you feel like that's an influence in it, or is this just...
Well, you know, look, first of all, I wrote both of them. You know, one of the tasks I set myself at a certain point was I had written these things, like Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, in the vernacular of the place that I came from, which is kind of a rough place. And if somebody's like using very harsh language, it pushes a lot of the audience out, audience that I would like to have hear what I have to say. And I set myself to, and also I felt it was kind of easy after a certain point to create a feeling of shock or of event by using like really extraordinarily brutal language. And I'm like, I want to see what I can do with like writing in a G-rated vein in terms of the language, if I can say everything it is that I want to say. And I found that to be a really useful obstacle for me that I don't always employ, but that I employ a lot since then, because I found that it made me work harder to say what I meant.
Well, let's talk about that process with Doubt, because you had this play that you've envisioned successfully as a play, and then you're re-envisioning it essentially as a film. What was that process like, going from one to the other, and, you know, what were the things that... was it frustrating going from one form to the other? Did you feel like you lost anything or wish...
No, I didn't feel like I lost anything. I mean, it was the hardest screenplay I ever wrote because it resisted being a screenplay. It was a four-character play, and three of the characters are dressed in black from head to foot. Nobody drives anywhere. Nobody kisses anybody. Nobody shoots anything. What are we going to do for, you know, an hour and 40 minutes? It's how do I make this cinematic? And I was writing it under rather adverse circumstances. And I got to page 50, and I hated every single page of what I'd written. And then on page 50, I wrote this one scene, and I thought, well, that would work. That scene would work as a film. And that gave me just enough heart to go back to page one and start to make it work on each page. I realized there was no overarching cinematic solution, that I was going to have to figure this out three or four times every page. How am I going to do this?
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top five school by USA Today, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with filmmaker and playwright John Patrick Shanley speaking with Barbara Morgan at a special event in 2016. Shanley won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay with his script for Moonstruck. He later adapted and directed his Tony Award-winning play, Doubt, for the screen. Doubt stars Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Clips in the following segment, copyright Miramax.
Every camera shot has to be motivated by something real that happens in the scene. So if somebody gets up and opens the blinds to get sunlight to come into a guy's eyes so that he might tell the truth, that's a reason for her to get up and open the blinds. If she gets up to open the blinds for no reason, then that's just bullshit. If she gets up to do this for a reason that has to do with the story, then that's a motivated move. When she gets up, the camera moves. When the camera turns around to see what she's seeing, that's a new angle. So you've justified something. Maybe that carries you through a third of one page. So I had to go back and have light bulbs blow out, have people get up and open and close blinds, have intercoms go off, have phones ring, have people knock on the door, anything and everything that I could think of, aiding and abetting the forward movement of the story to motivate camera moves. And then look for, you know, larger cinematic moments like the way the nuns eat versus the way the priests eat, that the nuns eat in silence, the priests eat in boisterous bonhomie, and they smoke and they drink and they eat good food, and the nuns, and this was true, eat lousy food and do not speak unless the Mother Superior rings a little bell, which he does about once a week.
This past Sunday, what do you think that sermon was about? Sister James?
Huh?
What was Father Flynn's sermon about?
Well, doubt. He was talking about doubt.
Why?
Excuse me, sister?
Well, sermons come from somewhere, don't they? Is Father Flynn in doubt? Is he concerned that someone else is in doubt?
I suppose you'd have to ask him.
No, that would not be appropriate. He is my superior, and if he were troubled, he should confess it to a fellow priest or to the Monsignor. We do not share intimate information with priests.
No, that's true.
What are we saying?
I want you all to be alert. I am concerned, perhaps needlessly, about matters in St. Nicholas School.
And so that dichotomy, which I could do without having anything said, allows the movie-going audience to have an experience and have their reaction without me telling them what to do.
So if you could sum up, though, and maybe you can, I don't know, but the perspective of how you approach going into a play and how you have to re-look at a story to go into a film.
Well, when you do, you know, like what I realized with Doubt, the one thing people kept asking me as soon as they heard I was doing this, they kept saying, are we going to see the kid that they were all talking about? And I'm like, well, yeah, you're going to see the kid. You got to see the kid. It's a movie. You can't be talking about a kid and not show the kid. People are like, where's the kid? They're talking about a kid. Why don't they show the kid? Camera's naturally going to go. The kid's looking around. Where's the kid? So as soon as you do that, you go like, oh, okay. You're not going to show one kid. That means you're going to show the kids. That means you're going to show classrooms full of kids. So that means you're going to do the line outside the school and the kids going into school in the morning. Those will all have to be scenes that have meaning in and of themselves. And so you're going to start to write that. And gradually you realize that when you were a playwright, you hypnotized yourself into thinking that you don't need any of that. And that when you do a movie, you go to all the natural places that that story would go. And that's how a movie, a play, naturally opens into being a film, is you wake yourself up from the spell of not going to the obvious places that you would go. Do you want to have a character that you know what that character would do? Like when Meryl Streep was playing Sister Aloysius, if I said to her, climb that wall, she would climb that wall as Sister Aloysius. she's always Sister Aloysius when she's Sister Aloysius, you know. And if you ask her to do something that isn't Sister Aloysius, she can't do it. She can only do Sister Aloysius things. That's when you really go inside a character. Philip Seymour Hoffman had to know what his backstory was. And I remember in rehearsal, I said to Phil, I said, do you want me to talk to you about that? You know, because some actors do and some actors don't. And he said, yeah, sure, why not? And because he wasn't going to give me too much. That was his personality. And I said, okay, come on out in the hall. I took him out in the hall and I told him, you know, what I thought. And he said, okay, good. He said, you know, but next time, you don't have to take me out in the hall. And I'm like, all right. We went back inside and Meryl said, what were you talking about out there? I looked at Phil and I was like, this is good, right? That's directing. Now everybody's paranoid. I did it as a play with a wonderful Irish actor named Brian F. O'Byrne. First of all, it's a different thing. He's from Ireland, and I'm Irish, and there's, you know, we have a different way of dealing with each other. Brian was terrific in the part. And, you know, I had that conversation with him. You know, you want me to talk to you about it? Sure, blah, blah, blah. And then he began to give out backstage that I had told him, you know, the secret of the play, and that at closing night he would reveal all. And a journalist told me this. And I said, that's true. That's true. I said, but I lied to Brian. Brian, when he would play the part, he told me this, that he would play, when he felt the audience liking him too much, he would do something a little shady. And when he felt them like turning against him too much, he'd charm them a little bit. He'd be like, aw, me. And during one fundraising episode, I got an email from the stage manager saying, Brian has been coming out, you know, because he's supposed to ask for money for equity fights AIDS. He's been coming out with a nun puppet and a priest puppet and asking the audience to vote. And I'm like, I'll be right over. So, it's like I took his puppets. No more puppets.
One of the things I feel like is in all of your work is this lack of judgment, not just of your characters, but of morality and life. And where did that come from in your work? I mean, has it always been there, you feel like, or is it just something you've explored yourself?
That's a really good observation. That's true. I'm not a judgmental person. I don't know what people should do. It is pretty interesting to notice what they do. And I can talk very subjectively and powerfully about what I feel I should do or shouldn't do. But life is something that takes place only in the present. And you apply the lessons of your personal history and the impersonal history of the world. But it's a constant judgment call in the moment, as far as I'm concerned. I think that the will is a very important part of the human personality, but it should be used sparingly. Because when you're too willful, life doesn't happen. It strangles everything.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. Back to screenwriter John Patrick Shanley describing life imitating art and the inspiration for his directorial debut, the 1990 adventure comedy, Joe Versus the Volcano.
I had gone through a period of 10 years where I had an aversion to direct sunlight. And I would walk along the street in that little shadow part there, you know, the street's all sunny, and I'd walk along and stay in the shadow part for like 10 years. And and if I went in the sunlight, I just felt kind of dizzy. I also, when I was 18, got a job at a place called American Cystoscope Makers, which made terrifying medical instruments. claws that pulled your chest back together after they'd ratcheted it open. I opened up my desk drawer the first day and it was filled with artificial testicles. And when I wrote Joe, this was the terrible, depressing job that he had. And I, you know, basically I designed the offices where I had worked and had people build them. Yeah, it's pretty crazy what you can do, you know, when people are behind you. Then, you know, I had Tom Hanks dress the way that I had dressed and sit at the desk that I had sat at and read the books that I had read. And you sort of like a weird recreation. And then after the 10 years, suddenly out of this incubation, I was ready to step into the sunlight and sort of declare who I was as a human being and take whatever place I thought that I should be in for myself. And I did. And I did, you know, I won the Academy Award and all this stuff, which is kind of stepping into the sunlight from the obscurity of the kind of writing life that I was living. And the first time that I went to Los Angeles for the first film that I had written, of the guy who was going to direct the film and who had optioned the screenplay, was a guy named Tony Bill, very nice guy. And it was my first time in Los Angeles, and he met me at the airport in a vintage sports car. And he said, I have a restaurant. And so I know all the restaurateurs in Los Angeles. And if it's okay with you, what I'd like to do is I'd just like to take you to the top five restaurants in Los Angeles tonight, and we'll have an appetizer and a chat with the chef in each of these places. I'm like, okay. And while we're doing this, he said, and with your permission, tomorrow I have a yacht, and we'll take my yacht to Catalina with my chef, and we'll have fresh abalone. Have you ever had fresh abalone? I'm like, no, I don't think I have. And so the next day, I'm out in direct sunlight on a yacht, tooling towards Catalina, and going like, wow, my life has changed. And Joe is sort of about that change, which part of me, you know, was staying in the shadow because I felt that I would die if I stepped into the light. And at many stages in my life, I have felt that if I did what was in my heart to do, I would be destroyed. Because the life that you have, whatever the life is that you have it. And to give it up for something else that doesn't exist, for all you know, that feels like suicide to me. And so I had to get used to committing suicide, which I did many times, where I would just say, I'm jumping, I'm going. I don't know where I'm going to live. I don't know who I'm going to be with. I don't know what I'm going to do it. And so Joe versus the volcano is a kind of metaphor for taking up that attitude. And then afterwards, you know, they're on the raft and he like starts to feel his throat closing up. He starts to have psychosomatic symptoms like I did a lot. And that's the after effects of not giving in to fear. Is that sort of fright, well, maybe I'm sick, or, you know, maybe I'll be run over by a car, or maybe if I do this thing, my career will be over, or whatever. And then finally just going like, well, maybe it will, but let's get on with it. Let's live. That's where that came from. I did a play called Outside Mullingar, and late in the play, the guy and the hero, who this woman wants to marry, he won't marry her, and she doesn't really know why, and she finally gets him alone and grills him until he finally admits what the problem is. And the problem is that he thinks he's a bee. He thinks he's a honeybee. Some people thought that was strange. In fact, my father was born on a farm outside Mullingar, which is still in my family, and is run by my cousin Anthony. That's the character in the play. And Rosemary is the name of my other first cousin over there, Rosemary Muldoon, same as in the play. And my uncle Tony, he's in the play. I didn't bother to change his name. And my Aunt Mary is off stage because she's passed away by that time, but she's in the play. And Anthony's never married. And I asked him once, why not? And he said, well, first of all, everything. And that was the end of his explanation. There is in in Caloocan, which is the town outside Mullingar where the farm is, there was a man who thought he was a honeybee. And he, when he was buried, had himself buried in a giant beehive-shaped stone mortuary, which I have visited many times. And that's where the idea came from. There was a disco in the town of Mullingar called The Bee, after this man. So he is famous within Mullingar, but perhaps not outside Mullingar. That's where that comes from. But we all think something, you know? You say, like, well, you know, what's, you know, when people are trying to explain why they don't go ahead and do their heart's desire, they always have some reason, maybe that they can't quite say. And it might simply be because I think I'm ugly, or because I think I'm stupid, or because I'm a freak, or because I don't deserve it. And those are all equivalent to me of saying, because I'm a honeybee. It's just some crazy thing you have. I'm very active on social media, but I'll tell you why. I mean, I got on Twitter when I did Outside Mullingar. I've been hearing about it. I was on Facebook for a long time, and I still am. And then Twitter, you know, there's a certain small maximum number of characters, and that attracted me because it's like a sonnet, you know, the structure of it. But basically, I get up in the morning, and a lot of days I'm kind of stupid, and I don't write in between usually. So I write stuff that I write, and then when I'm not writing, I'm not writing. And I don't really push myself to write when I'm not writing. In other words, I guess I don't have anything to say right now, so I should shut up. But I found that it was really good, like a gymnasium, for me to have to come up with something I could live with, as a posting on Twitter or Facebook. And I fail. I have written some very embarrassing things where I'm like, wow, that's really bad. But even the humiliation is useful in the sense that, well, you're going to have to do better than that. And I think it's good to, on a daily basis, strive for excellence, even in very small amounts. Because I found, after I did this for a while, that I actually wrote better. And I was shocked by that. One of the most famous, or the most famous poet of his day in China, whose name I want to say was Li Po, but don't hold me to it, he would lie by the bank of the river, most famous poet in China, and write poems and throw them in the river and watch them float away. And that's what I feel about my posts on Twitter.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.